on what region you're in, a particular time of year, certain things. You take this one out because you want to make sure that you don't have earthquakes. But the Gyoki map begins to become intertwined with that and talismans. And so it's a Gyoki map. It's also a talisman. In addition, so you have your primary islands here. You've got two tips of Ezo. That's presented here, Matsume and Ezo. You've got the tips of Korea presented here as two different areas. You have Ryukyu here. And those of you in the front can read this. The Island of Women is presented here. Island of Women first introduced in the Shanghai Jing. In Japan, there's two traditions for the Island of Women. One is Buddhist and one comes from the Chinese precedent. But it's a mythical place, a magical place. And in, depending on which version, one is where it's only women and they eat men and somewhere to the south and west-ish of Japan. And so, again, identity. So here's Japan in a traditional map-making method in a circle of the world, contextualized regionally with real places, Hokkaido, Korea, Ryukyu, and the Island of Women. So a combination of real places and mythical places like we saw in Korea. Same kinds of constructs, same idea about identity. The West is here. All of these issues are coming to bear and are being made manifest in maps, in unique formats, in unique constructs, just like this. And this one, in this particular one, you also have the introduction of the compass rose, which is most assuredly a Western trope that's introduced into map making in Japan in the late 18th and through the 19th century. But what's interesting is, so you have east, west, north, south, but then you have the 12 directions, the traditional directions developed in China but used through all of East Asia. So you have a kind of combination of east-west as a compass rose without the fleur-de-lis that we typically would see on something like that. And then this wonderful little cartouche, which took me three scholars to figure out what it says. Max Norman, who's at Barnard College, Columbia. It's the name of all of the provinces that are landlocked. But it's using their historical nicknames to join them together into a poem. Why is that interesting? I see lots of heads nodding. Like, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Why is that interesting? Because all the landlocked provinces don't have direct access to water and the West. And so again, we have these kinds of hints, information that's telling us why something like this is created, and this kind of joining of past traditions, new traditions, creating new things, as all part of identity in cartography in the late 18th and early 19th century in all of East Asia. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peck, for your fascinating talk. Now the floor is open for discussions and questions.
I'll entertain any question.
Yeah, anyone.
Doesn't have to be about maps.
One question, please raise your hand, and I'm going to pass the mic to you.
So all you Chinese literature majors should think about taking Japanese literature classes and Korean literature classes. Have a new staff member teaching Korean literature.
Well, thanks for your fascinating talk. I was really intrigued. Now I think I'm very interested to see all these maps here. Well, the history of gender and the history of early modern Korea. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about Chonado, the Korean mm-hmm. map, you didn't really talk about the influence of Ricci map, but you did for Japan. So I'm just curious as to know during this time when you're drawing this world map, Chonado, whether this Ricci map also heavily influenced Korea.
So you have two Chonado. You have the, and I showed you both. You have this style, which most people, when they think of Chonodo, this is what they're thinking of. But you also have, way back, this one. This is also from a Chonodo. And this is the Rechino. But understood that it's not, so it's kind of subtle the point I was making. Ricci and Ricci's map, it's not actually Ricci's map. The ideas that Ricci introduces, the world is round, that we have lots of continents with water around it, that's what becomes Ricci in all of East Asia. And so 200 years later, 170 years later, when they're looking to the past for when the West came and maps were introduced, the Ricci West idea, all of this is kind of conflated together. And this is part of the reason it's very interesting as a phenomenon. If you do research on Ricci, Western research, major guy, the map he produces, so much information, it's fantastic. It's like a major milestone. In East Asia, when it's introduced, it's eccentric, it's kind of interesting, it's not embraced in any way until later. Actually, the first to sort of re-embrace it is in Korea, in the court, in 1708. So the last map that Ricci does is 1608. And so, who's the king, Sukjong in 1708?
Yeah,
Sukjong. And so he commissions, so he's actually having calendar reform. So they're updating the calendar, and they're looking to the Chinese updates. And so as you know, the Joseon court doesn't accept the Qing takeover, the Manchu takeover. And so they continue reign dates, Ming reign dates, continuously. So what happens on the 60th anniversary, so 1644 is when the Qing takes over. In 1704, you begin to see, so the Korean court takes on they become the champions for the Ming court. And so they're interested in things that happened in the Ming. And so they're looking to the calendar reform that happens in the 1630s, and they use those updates for the movements of the moon. But at the same time, he commissions two maps, full-scale maps. The 1608 Ricci map, and Adam von Schell's, also Ming, star chart. And so both of those are reproduced in the Korean court. And part of it is the 60th anniversary of the takeover of the Manchus, but it's also the 100th anniversary of when the map is first introduced and produced in China, in Ming China. So there's all three very specific Ming events that are happening, and Sukjong is very keen on sort of producing things and continuing the late Ming phenomenon onwards. And so it's actually, then there's a gap, so that's 1708. So there's quite a bit of debate in Korea and between me and Professor Chen about how to date this. This one in particular. This one's a trick. It's quite tricky. It is, so in the Kyu Jangak, it's given a 1780s Yongzhou reign date. It's not dated. None of these are dated. He wants to push back the tradition of the Chonhado to textual evidence that we have from the 15th and 16th century, and I said that's all fine, but you can't start pushing these maps back that far because they simply weren't produced at that time. So we know that these maps are produced in the 1880s, and I didn't show you any examples, and there's quite a few of those. So this becomes a problem. So I've problematized it in the fact that at the same time that it's happening in China and Japan, that the Korean court creates the beginnings of this atlas, the Yojido format, and the map that they use, like we see in China and Japan, is this map, is this Ricci. So it's not actually a Ricci map. This is the Sansai two-way map. But it might have been the Ricci map, if you remember. We don't have the extant 1898 map. This could have been what it looked like, something like this. So So there's some debate about actually dating this, but in any case, there's no question that it has to do with identity and all of these things that are happening. And so all of them use Ricci in different ways, and then all of them, so I sort of conclude with what do they do uniquely to each, within each, all of those. I answered your question, but I added,
I was familiar with, you know, the calendar, the reform calendar, but not really about this map. And, you know, especially when you're thinking about this related to constructing identity, I think this is fascinating. But in the other tunnel, actually the one with the blue, another interesting thing that I found was there's a red circle mark in China and Korea, Chungbuk and Chosun. So I think that also relates to identity issue. So, I mean, do you still see that as center of the world? Or, I mean, I don't, so do you have any idea what that, what the implications
of that is? So it's an interesting, so as we all know, the characters, Zhongguo, means Middle Kingdom. And this idea of the middle of the world, and this is a very much goes to the construct of Chinese imagination of us and them. Zhongguo is us, and really everybody else, Koreans included, are Yi. Foreigners, barbarians, whatever the translation is, but they're the non-us. And so this idea of I think it's too simplistic to make the assumption that in this particular circumstance that this is still the center of the world. I think if you think of it, all of these things, this is the region that we know, and so this has real place names. Again, I was talking about this before we started the talk, it's all made up. This, as you know, the planet is not covered with lines that divide places with a big character, and there's not floating in the middle of the ocean, Japan Sea, or Eastern Sea. Those things don't exist. It's all made up. It's a construct. It's a way for us to talk about and convey visually, so we have common ground and a point of entry to discuss things. But I think it's a little too simplistic that this particular map is still talking about China as the center of. I think it's more about the real, regional, but it also, you know, this is a Buddhist continent. There's no question. Why is it that it breaks down only to four? This isn't even a river. It's a sea. It's an inland sea. It's the Black Sea. This is not a river either. It's the Persian Gulf. And so the construct is to fit a particular set of criteria that is comfortable. And, you know, you can, so as a Korean, you can look at this and say, here we are. You know, you could just as easily say, so disregard the actual meaning of the character, Zhongguo, and just think of it, so here's China, but here we are. This is a map about Korea. This is not about China. This is a map about Korea. Look at it, it's right smack dab in the middle of the action. This is the center of the world. And we have China, and they're on the same scale as us. You know, we visually portray them the same way. You know, Ryukyu in Japan, they're rectangles. They're not the oval with the purple ring around it. So, you know, it's all about conveying something that's, it's not just about being comfortable. It's a kind of pride. It's a kind of, you know, every people has its own creation myth, its own idea of sense, of self, and all of those things. And that's what this is conveying, that it has this huge long history that goes back thousands of years, from literary constructs, from real places, fake places, Buddhist, Taoist. This is quintessentially everything that makes Korean culture in terms of a construct of a map. What are you missing? You've got a little West, you've got Buddhist, Taoist, historical, literary, real places. I challenge anyone to come up with a map as good as that.
Thank you. Actually, just continuing the notion, it seems to me maps in the East Asian tradition actually were more symbolic, like theater props. So they would be kind of they do have approximate locations, but in fact, it is much more suggestive to their ideology or concept of the world.
Yeah.
So I was very, actually the man next to Jonathan's office is what I donated.
Yes.
It's the original, is in Japan.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is actually the whole periphery is eerily like today's map, when it was made some time ago.
Yeah.
And so they managed to approach the Western style map while keeping the original kind of this other information in there. So I think your lecture really, I learned a lot today because, but I had also a question about the relationship between your book and Gary Lindbergh's book on cartography.
Yeah.
So how are they different?
So you forgot, when my book came, just before my book came out, I came here and we met each other and you asked me the same question.
Yeah.
So, so the question is related to, there's a series that began in the late 80s called The History of Cartography, University of Chicago Press. It's ongoing. They're only now at the 19th century in terms of writing it. So who knows, it'll be another 5 years till it's actually produced. But volume two, book two, is East Asia. It includes Vietnam. I don't know why they think that's part of East Asia, but the compilers considered that. And Gary Ledyard wrote the chapter on Korean maps. So there's actually three chapters on Chinese maps, one long chapter on Japanese maps, and a long chapter, Ledyard's chapter on Korean maps. So lots of things I have to say are different than Gary's. And I think part of when that was conceived, so that came out in 92, I think, 1992. Actually, it was just recently, 2 years ago, translated into Korean, the whole chapter, as a freestanding book. The issue was, for them, they had to convey the entire history of Korea or Japan or China in 80 pages, which is virtually impossible to do. And so all of those essays are flawed in that they're big gaps, there are errors, there are things that, and that's the reason that you know, any given book is all the information you know at that time. And Jonathan Chase, I had dinner with him last night, he gave me his recent book, and he immediately pointed out the two footnotes that were inaccurate. And I said, but it's what you knew at the time. He said, don't soft sell this. And I said, no, well, you need future generations have to be able to go back and say, the reason that this footnote is wrong, because now we've discovered that there's this text, etc. So for example, Ledger talks about a particular, the most famous cartographer in Korea is Kim Jong-ho. And so he creates this map in the 1860s. But in the 1830s, his very first map is a map that's based on a Chinese map. And it's actually a map that we have, the map itself, the original map, is in our collection. And I had no idea about that, that it's significant until I started publishing, and then I saw that the map apparently was available in lots of different contexts. And somehow in 1990, Mr. McLean was in Beijing and paid $100 for it. At Leo Lee Chong, which is hard to believe. But in any case, so Ledger talks about the Kim Jong-ho's version, it's a woodblock printed copy of that map, and the information that he has is based on a Korean encyclopedia that was created in the 1840s. The Korean encyclopedia made a mistake. First about who actually the cartographer was, it's signed, but it's the second character is a little hard to read. And so he made a mistake. And So there are several errors related to that map, and Ledger talks about it in his essay. I follow 30 years later, and I realize that the source, so I ultimately look for, so where is he getting this from? What is this information? Where does it come from? I find that it's a source, it's a Korean encyclopedia, and I go to the Korean encyclopedia, and I look, and I read it, and I say, oh, well, you know, so Ledger is using a historical document, that's your proof, that's your locus classicus, so this must be the case, because I'm not making it up, here it is in 1849. Well, it turns out that someone made a mistake in that publication, and so it's not that Ledger is wrong, because the source he's using is wrong. So the issue becomes then, so I've corrected it in another publication as a footnote, so the question is, how do my opinions differ from Ledger's? For example, this is a perfect example. So he obviously talks about Chonhado, major important map. He talks about the derivation of this shape as coming from a very well-known map that was originally produced in 1402. We don't have any original copies. There's actually one in Japan. The Gangnido is its nickname. It shows the central kind of continent, and Africa, and India, and all these places in the four. And he visually morphs that map into this map. Made it up. Just made it up. So there's four maps that he does in between, which are just made up shapes. So he somehow morphs that map because he's looking for the origins. Everybody wants to know. This is what historians do. We have an object, and we want to know. Okay, so this person created it at this time, but what are they thinking about? What have they looked at? What are their sources? Who have they talked to? All of this kinds of information. And so when I read that. And I look at it, and it's a big chart. It's like a half a page. I said, what do you base that on? And so it was at that time that I happened to walk into it. So the corporate headquarters, so the guy I work for is this, he's not crazy at all. He's a fantastic billionaire. And the Asian Art Museum and the Map Library, these are two of his hobbies, lesser hobbies. But in the corporate headquarters is a Western map, and I literally just read that section, and I saw the shape, and I said, "Well, wait a second, I just saw that shape on a Korean map of the early 19th century," and I said, and so I took that map, and in my book I juxtaposed the two, and so where Ledger is making something up, so I do an outline. And I take that red outline and I put it right next to this detail, and there's no question, that's exactly the same shape. The continent of Asia, conceived in Western map making, is exactly that shape. And so this is an example of where he has speculated on something, and someone later has come along and said, I don't think that this shape is based on the Gangnido. I don't think that that's a valid argument, but here's one that I suggest is my counterpoint to that. So that's just one example of, so I'm building on what he did. I think that I've talked to the editors. They wouldn't ask someone now to write an entire history in 80 pages. You just can't do it.
So how would they have seen that kind of map?
So how would the Koreans have seen this map?
I mean the Western map.
How would they have seen it? That's an excellent question. But we know, you know, the Korean court, it's, we know that Western mapping is in China. And we know that there are constant envoys going back between the Joseon court and the Ming court, the Qing court. It doesn't stop, it never stops. And so whether they're official envoys or private citizens, we have lots of scholars who go there on their own, you know, ticket, but there's a constant back and forth. And so Western maps, there's no question that there are Western maps in the Beijing court. And so someone got one. And, you know, and who knows? Did he take it back? Did he make a copy of it? Did he make a sketch? Did he have an artist with him who, you know, this, but this is, this, these are the, this is why this, what I, everything I presented today isn't the quintessential end to this conversation. It's ongoing. We don't know. These are not signed. We don't know who made them. We don't know who asked to make them. We just see, and this is part of the point that I, and the perspective that I have, all of East Asia. So if you're only looking at a sort of Korean tradition, like ledger is, then yes, the Gangmi-do is the place. That's the major milestone in cartography that you want to look and somehow link the two together. But if you take a little step back and you look at what's happening in China and what's happening in Japan at exactly the same time, and you begin to realize that it's much more complex than that. It's not, none of these are simple kinds of, you know, A plus B equals C. It's A plus C and Q and R and P and that equals D. Yes?
Could you elaborate on the use of, about three questions in my mind? Who, when, and where?
Sure. So the, these atlases in the 19th century are created in huge numbers. So these are for, like the map plate in Japan, for a general audience. These are not court-driven. They might have been court-inspired. And that's part of the debate for this other kind, this, the world Chunhado. But these are for mass consumption. This is the entire nation, state, has to begin to think about these kinds of issues, issues of identity and the world, and you know where we sit in that, and our relationship. And so it's, these are mass produced. So for example, in our collection, we have got eight Yojido. And no shortage of like single images, whether cut out the Chunhado or cut out the Korean Peninsula or one of the provinces. We probably have another 10 or so of those. So there's quite a number, and from all levels. So woodblock printed, I've only shown you manuscript versions, but actually the other world one, that's woodblock printed. So higher production value, lower production value, colored versions, plain, just black and white versions, beautifully colored versions, hand colored versions, print colored versions. So you have a whole range of production that's being made through the 19th century. Throughout the entire 19th century. This particular one could even be early 20th century. It's virtually impossible to date them. But because of this funny blue that's used, it looks almost like magic marker. It's not. But this particular style is something that happens as kind of transition to 1890s, 1910, something like that.
Was it also used for talismanic or decorative purposes?
Well, remember, it's a book. So, maybe.
Only in books, because not.
No. So, for example, you know, I mean, this has become the Chunhado, and now, you know, you can go to Insadong, and there's that guy, right? Gosh, I still, by the palace. What's the road? I'm just blanking out.
Insadong.
Well, it's a Gyeongbok palace, but there's an artist, and he's become famous for, I have one, and it hangs in my house. So it has become a standalone image, because it is, but that's very much a late 20th century, again, but I think, too, it's about identity. You know, this is a construct that's uniquely Korean. And so, all of the things of Korean nation state and pride and all of those, here's a, you know, standalone map that has come to represent that.
I'm afraid it's time, and we will have to save the rest of the questions after the event. Please join me in thanking again Dr. Richard Beck for his talk. Thank you all for coming.
on Qing Dynasty court theater performances.
Mm-hmm.
They mentioned a lot about Tianxia being a globe.
Yes.
So the word show
appears
a lot in those kind of supposedly borrowed from Ming Dynasty core materials, but they definitely updated their view of the world, even in their theatrical entertainment.
So we actually, I'm organizing a conference on the earliest known Chinese globe. It's in the British Library, of all places. 1623, it's Wan Li period. Four-color lacquer, an actual globe. It's spectacular, produced by two other Jesuits working in the Chinese court in the late Wan Li. So they arrive just after Sorici dies in 1610, and they come in 1615 and 1618, and they produce, the court produces this fantastic globe. So this idea is immediately accepted. But in the Sansai Tuhui version, not the big Ricci, this idea of around the world, Terry, it was all those things. It's quite interesting.
So I wonder, the big blue mat created by, I guess it's commissioned by the Jiang Chen Emperor.
Judging,
So I wonder what's the purpose of creating
so that. So right before that, you've got... So the original purpose was, again, if you remember, Qianlong now has a relationship with every border.
Yeah, yeah. So we have two borders.